Choke points.
Let's go.
West Seattle Bridge update. The long-anticipated analysis on whether to repair or replace the bridge has now been upstaged in a big way by a bright, shiny new object, a rapid replacement that could return full service, in under 3 years. Chris, what has changed here?
Well, this is this rapid ride thing, or not rapid ride, rapid replacement we started hearing about last week. And at the community task force meeting, we got a chance to listen to the guy who's pitching it. And what's interesting is that the community task force that has been advising Mayor Jenny Durkan on whether to repair or replace had been waiting on the cost-benefit analysis for months. They've been arguing over, we don't know the numbers, we don't know this, we don't know that. They got that CBA on Monday, and then they were expected to do a deep dive into it yesterday. But instead, they were wowed by bridge engineer Ted Zolli of HNTB, a company that the city has hired to design a potential replacement bridge. Zolli is proposing a steel twin-span bridge that is 40% lighter than concrete and could last 100 years.
100 years?
Yep. It would use the existing bridge piers and supports. It's a bridge that he says he can build by the first quarter of 2023. To do that, he would demolish the existing span while building the new ones off-site.
The approaches and the arches can be built at different fabrication shops independent of each other. And here you can see that we have two arches, twin arches, and they're delivered and lifted independent of each other, and perhaps could be open to traffic independent of each other.
And because they're using the existing piers and supports, that means little in-water work, which means limited disruption for the low bridge.
There's very few bridges, I can think of none, where the swing bridge opens underneath the span we're trying to replace. It's a very constrained, very busy site.
And that lack of in-water work would also greatly reduce the amount of environmental work and permitting that would be needed to speed up delivery. Zolli did about 5 years worth of environmental work in 6 weeks while replacing a bridge over Lake Champlain between New York and Vermont. So he knows it can be done. The question is, can it be done in Seattle, which loves rules and regulations and process? Task force member Dan Austin.
Whenever I hear fast tracking of EIS in the city of Seattle, thoughts of lawsuit alarms ensuing go off loudly.
It became quite clear that many on the task force do not believe the city has the guts to do it. Port of Seattle Commissioner Peter Steinbrück.
With a 2023 delivery, well, I do believe miracles can happen if there's a will and a determination, but they're very rare, particularly with regard to Seattle process.
But Zolli believes it can be done if leaders change their thinking.
I just don't buy that we can't figure out how to replace bridges quickly when we need to. So I just can't think of a project in the country that's more worthy of a fast-track replacement than this bridge.
Member Diane Sosny, who represents nurses in West Seattle, summed it up this way.
I don't see it a question of miracles. So, you know, I sort of want to take that word out of the equation. I think this is about political will.
So we shall see if city leaders will have the will to fast-track environmental work to save West Seattle from dying on the vine. Of course, this shiny new option has to be thoroughly vetted and put through its paces, but if the decision is made to go with replacing the bridge instead of repairing it first, it is certainly a very intriguing option, and it certainly got the attention of everyone on the task force. And fast-tracking the environmental work isn't the only thing that's going to take some heavy lifting. Finding funding for any option is going to be difficult. Here's the city's Heather Marks.
Ted's can-do attitude is amazing.
Yeah.
And I have a can-do attitude, but what we're going to need is a can-do attitude on the part of elected officials who are in control of money that is going to be needed in order to complete this bridge.
In some other West Seattle bridge news that came out yesterday, the photo enforcement cameras that will be watching the Lower Spokane Street Bridge will be installed next month. The signs warning of their installation should be going up this weekend. Warnings are expected to go out December 1st, with $75 tickets coming in the mail in January if you use the bridge when you're not supposed to. If you are not a bus, an emergency vehicle, a van pool, or company shuttle, you are going to get a ticket if you use that lower bridge between 5 a.m. and 9 p.m.
So back to this issue of political will. That implies that there's somebody who wants to use environmental rules to just delay the replacement of the bridge. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, what we're hearing, Dave, is you know how the Seattle process works, and that whenever something that's different or new comes forward, there's usually some group, we don't know who it is, right now would sue because they say, well, you're not following the normal rules. That's the way things normally work in Seattle. If you don't like something, it ends up getting, there's a lawsuit. And so they're the people there are talking about, this is what usually happens. We hope mm-hmm. it doesn't happen. And what we need to do is to get people all on board in the same page to realize this is for the best, even if we have to cut some environmental, not cut the corners, but fast track things and go through things in a different way. Because the Seattle process, as you know, can bog things down forever.
Yes, I keep hearing that. But the Seattle process isn't some amorphous thing from another planet. It's individuals who decide that they want to block something just to block it. This is not a bridge that's being built for the first time. The corridor's already got piers in it going into the fishery or whatever it is where the salmon
they're in the Duwamish, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like we're talking about people who would just block it for the sake of blocking it, or am I being unfair?
Well, potentially, or the blocking it because they don't feel that all of the environmental regulations were followed the right way. I think what this is you heard a lot of people getting concerned that, oh my gosh, we have a really good, intriguing idea here, but in order to make sure it happens, we've got to make sure that everyone is cool with fast tracking. They're kind of speaking out in advance of mm-hmm. something potentially happening so they can head it off before it even gets going. I think they're trying to get public opinion behind the fact that we don't need this thing to be caught up in court or caught up in any way. We need everyone to realize that this needs to happen if this is the choice that the mayor makes. I think it's kind of a preemptive look at, oh man, this sounds too good to be true, and wouldn't it be just like Seattle to blow mm-hmm. up with some
But so far, nobody has stepped up and said, we just want to, we're anti-car, and therefore we're just going to not replace the bridge.
No, and the thing about this particular span is it could be expanded to get light rail on it, too. Mm-hmm. So I think the people who...
Well, there you go.
So, I mean, there's a ways to scale that thing they're looking at to expand the facility, potentially. So, and again, we haven't even... The mayor hasn't even made the decision if we're going with repair or replace, and then to determine what the replacement would be if she decides the repair a replacement route. That's all going to be determined at another long study. But I just thought it was interesting that the tenor of yesterday was like, oh my gosh, this is really interesting. Boy, I hope we don't screw it up.
Yeah.
If that's our option.
We all hope they don't screw it.
Yeah, that is true.
As the race for a vaccine heats up, Washington State health officials have released plans for getting it to everybody once it is ready. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott joins us now with the details. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Yes. So the state health department delivered this to the CDC last Friday, and they released it to the public here yesterday. Assistant State Health Secretary Michelle Roberts says the most important thing to know about the state vaccination plan at this point is.
I want to emphasize this is version one of the plan. As I said last week, the plan is more of a guidebook about the work we need to do to plan and to ensure we're ready, and less of a detailed having all the answers at this point. The plan's going to evolve over time as we get feedback from partners, the community, the further guidance that still needs to come from the federal government.
That said,
the plan itself outlines the specific actions and steps the department will take. Like developing equitable vaccine allocation, developing the strong infrastructure with healthcare providers for vaccine distribution and clinical training, how we're going to be tracking vaccine administration data, and how we really need to communicate and learn about the questions and concerns the public may have. So we're ready to be answer that and provide information.
So the vaccine itself, they're going to start to do, they're going to look at the distribution process through an equity lens, and they've already started conducting some focus groups.
With communities that are disproportionately impacted by COVID, we're also talking with essential workers and the business sector. Key groups include the African American and Black communities, Latinx communities, Pacific Islander communities, immigrant and refugee communities, older adults, people experiencing homelessness, farm workers, people with underlying health conditions, and individuals with disabilities. So in that group, you'll see a lot of the people who we know have been disproportionately impacted by COVID disease, or some of the places where we've seen outbreaks happening.
You know, other groups that they want to hear from?
We're also engaging with different communities and sectors who are at higher risk for getting or spreading COVID disease. So once again, including essential workers, healthcare providers, college students, early learning providers, and parents. We're gathering feedback from these interviews and focus groups and community conversations, and that's what's going to help inform our plans going forward, help us figure out what are the criteria and around equitable distribution. How can we help use that information to continue to figure out how we're sub-prioritize vaccines when there's not enough for everybody who wants to be vaccinated?
And that's the big thing. So it's expected it'll be limited when it is available. No more than 500,000 doses, I believe, for our state is the expectation in the initial round. So they have this plan that's, again, very fluid and will likely change over time. They are looking at first responders, possibly nursing home residents, healthcare workers, folks like that who might get this initial round. But they also want to talk to these communities of color and make sure that those communities that have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, they have an opportunity to get some as well in the early phases. So that's all still being worked out. The other big issue here is cost. And while the federal government has vowed to make the vaccine available to everybody for free, Robert says it's not quite that simple.
Usually there is healthcare providers, even though they can't charge for the vial of vaccine, they could either charge what's called an administrative fee, which just kind of covers their time and materials for giving it, and potentially an office visit fee. That will be covered by health insurance. There's legislation had some language around to make sure that's covered for ACIP recommended vaccines. We still need more information on, is there going to be limits to how much those fees could be? Another piece is we're doing thinking on around is how do we make sure there's access and who's going to cover those types of related costs for anybody who doesn't have health insurance. So those are pieces we need to do some more planning around.
Wow, this is really complicated. I thought it was just a matter of making sure of just having the vaccine available in all the drugstores and doctor's offices, and you go in and get it.
No, and that's a whole nother thing that they're going through right now, that they're trying to make sure that they have that infrastructure set up that I didn't even get into, but that's just a part of it. No, there's a lot more to it. They need to make sure too that they have, you know, that we don't see kind of the disruptions we did at the beginning of the pandemic when we talk about testing delays or testing issues or supply issues, PPE shortages, things like that. So that's all of the stuff that they're trying to work on right now. It's really, really, really a big, big undertaking.
Why would it be any different than the flu vaccine? I mean, like a month ago, I walked in, got my flu vaccine. It, you know, it took 10 minutes and it was over with.
It just, again, because of kind of the way we've seen everything roll out on such a large scale, they have lessons that they say they've learned back in with the H1N1 vaccine when it came out, there were issues there. And she said they are using, you know, their regular vaccine kind of system that they use for all other vaccines as their starting point, but there's just much more involved when it comes to the COVID vaccine, and especially when everybody's going to be wanting it, and especially when you're talking about limited availability at the beginning. So that's why. So hopefully the months that they have to work this out, they should be ready to go once it gets here. We'll see.
So that's the key. They don't really have enough for everybody, so they have to prioritize the people, the groups that need it. I thought that several of the manufacturers had already gone ahead and created millions and millions of doses that are just waiting for approval. It's not like they have to start from scratch here.
Nope. Yep. You're absolutely right. But Washington State in the initial phase, I believe, is expected to get 2% of the vaccine that's available. So it's a small amount.
So they allocate it by state, what, based on population or?
I don't know if it's based on population or how it went. I just know she said in her initial plan that it was expecting that they would get 2% of the available vaccine. And then in phase two, it's supposed to be much more widely available. Now, the other issue here is in phase three, it would be everywhere. That's not at this point expected to happen until like summer, maybe. There's the latest polls show 58% of people in the U.S. are saying that they'd be willing to take the vaccine. So they have a whole nother issue they have to do, which is the public outreach. And there's a whole plan for that because they need to make sure that everybody buys in or it doesn't work.
Yeah. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Yes, it is time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Getting treats to kids this Halloween is going to require a few more tricks than usual. Of course, during the pandemic, traditional trick-or-treating isn't safe. You know, kids have to stand too close, reach into the bowls. So in Toronto, Canada, a plumber came up with a solution, a candy chute.
So we use 5 feet of 4-inch PVC pipe. We have orange spray paint, black duct tape, and some zip ties, and that's it.
Jeff Burke spoke with the Canadian Broadcasting Company. He says the black and orange chute is strapped directly on top of the sloped railing on his front stairs, so the candy flies down at a safe distance, of course, right into the hands of a trick-or-treater.
Trick or treat!
Whoa, nice.
He says he got the idea from a story he saw about a similar creation in Ohio, and I know a lot of people are doing these. Jeff's chute is intended to do more than just satisfy that sweet tooth, though. He launched a campaign called the Candy Chute Challenge. He offered to install the chutes at other homes in the area in exchange for a $25 donation to the Daily Food Bank. In the first 2 days, he got 400 requests.
I was definitely surprised at how quick it got attention. I knew there would be, you know, some standing behind it, but to have the 400 in the 2 days was pretty outstanding.
He had a goal to raise $10,000 for the food bank, and so with these 400 requests, he's right on target. He actually stopped taking new requests for the chutes, but he hopes other people will pick up on the idea.
I mean, I just hope that we can help, you know, facilitate a safe and happy Halloween for everyone and, you know, again, bring some joy back.
Here we go.
So Jeff says if you want to make your own chute, all you need is 4-inch PVC pipe. I hear that, you know, smaller, the candy won't fit down, just some zip
Depends
ties.
Depends on the candy you're giving out.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you two doing for on Halloween night?
I haven't considered that, but that's very tempting. A little one of those T-shirt guns. You could just shoot it out, shoot it down the driveway, right?
I'll be there for whoever, whatever kid wants to come by, and I'll still be opening the door and masked up. I love Halloween, but I don't, you know, I want it to be safe too.
Yeah, hopefully kids can still have fun on Halloween night.
You could hand out the candy with one of those grabbers.
I could do that too. I may just wear gloves to hand the candy out and. I'll just hand out hand sanitizer instead of candy.
We're going to use barbecue tongs.
Good call. Barbecue tongs. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. I guess you heard that Mr. Obama was back on the campaign trail.
I don't care about the polls. There were a whole bunch of polls last time. Didn't work out because a whole bunch of folks stayed at home and got lazy. And complacent. Not this time. Not in this election.
And there were no there was no applause because the audience was in their cars. Of course, it was one of those drive-through rallies. Do you think he's an effective part of the Biden campaign at this point, G?
Absolutely. And this was a perfect time to do it. It is the sharpest attack on the Trump administration since he turned over those keys. Sometimes, Dave, the old saying is, hey, you know what? I ain't got time for this. I ain't got time for this. And then sometimes when someone tells you, you know what? I got time today. Barack Obama had time yesterday and he laid it out. And some of those things the people are upset about. Why? Because Barack Obama pointed out the fact that there is no plan to replace Obamacare. That's a fact. There has been no plan. There's always talk about what's going to happen. And the fact that he's calling out the president by saying that the things that he does that people excuse and say, oh, that's just how he is. He's like, what? That you wouldn't allow your principal to talk that way. You wouldn't allow your boss can't get away with talking that way. President Trump is the only person in this country that gets away with what he does. And so I think that it was the perfect time for this to happen. You're talking about right now, we're 12 days before election. I'm glad that Barack Obama came out and laid it out for everyone to hear. Even though I don't believe that there are some people that are undecided. I mean, there's some undecided voters out there. Very little, I believe. Either way, I do believe that November 3rd, the country is going to show that we're tired of this and it's time to move forward. My only worry is what's going to happen November 4th through January 20th or 21st, whatever date that is.
Lacey, did you want to jump in?
Hey, Lacey.
Oh, yes. Hi, G. Sure. I assume you're going to be watching tonight's debate with a bucket of popcorn.
Absolutely.
I don't know. One theory we've heard is that the president will actually follow the rules tonight in hopes that Joe Biden will trip over himself. I mean, what are you watching for specifically tonight?
I'm looking forward to the new format, and I hope that this new format makes it to where going forward we continue to do this. And the new format is those mics are shut off when you're not asked a question. I think this is beautiful for that to happen. I think that's going to hurt President Trump. If I was Trump, I wouldn't even do this I wouldn't do this one either, because I think more tonight, I think what I'm really looking for, Lacey, I'm looking for Joe Biden, now that the fact that it's going to be a little bit controlled and the fact that Trump is not going to be able to interject and be rude. I'm looking for Biden to really lace out some facts. And if you really start thinking about facts, the one fact that remains out here right now is this. Our kids are at home and not at school. There's over 200,000 Americans that are no longer here anymore because of the coronavirus, a coronavirus in which our president downplayed, in which he knew more about in February. You can't gloss over those facts. And so tonight I'm looking for Joe Biden to put that out there in more sharper way than he's ever done before.
But Trump is going to argue the reason they're not in school is because Democrats have overreacted. I mean, did you hear last night? He was going COVID. I'm sick of hearing about COVID. He still doesn't think it's a big deal.
Now, who's he talking to? Like when he says I'm sick of talking about COVID, that's interesting, because I know some people that are collecting unemployment right now because of COVID. I know some small businesses in this country that are closed down because of COVID. I know a lot of kids are at home and not at school because of COVID. I know kids that aren't playing sports right now because of COVID. So when he says he's tired of talking about COVID, who's he talking to?
I think he's talking to people like you who'd like to see all that stuff come back. I think he's saying, why are we being so cautious? We have a treatment now. I went through the treatment. I'm fine. Let's open up the schools. Let's put people back in the stands, et cetera.
Yeah, well, you know that treatment that you're talking about? My cousin Michael wasn't able to get that treatment. He died. There's a lot of Americans that can't get the treatment that the president has gotten. And I would hope that at some point, as if he wants to be president of the United States, that he can come down to reality, not be so disconnected to the American people, and understand that all of us can't get that treatment. Dave, right now, can you get that treatment that he got?
I have no idea. He said it would be available to everybody, but
he said it, and he also said it would be free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. G and Ursula, 9 o'clock, Cairo Radio. Appreciate Thanks, you. G.
This is the sound of one voice.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The pandemic has completely upended the performing arts. Theater companies have mothballed themselves. Patrons are trying to figure out how to keep them alive. And the organizations are coping as best they can. And one of them is the Northwest Girl Choir, which is going to put together a virtual performance. And we have their director, Sarah Booz, on the line. So tell me how this is going to work.
Yeah, it's a big process of doing everything separately and then putting it all back together. You make practice video and audio tracks, and then each girl listens to that in her own home and sings along with it while recording herself by video. And then she sends that in to us. And we engineer all those, put them all back together on a screen with the audio, and then it all works. It takes a lot of time,
yeah,
but it works.
Well, at least you really have to know your stuff. You can't hide behind the others when every part is essentially a solo, right?
No, you cannot. No, we have some really strong singers in our choir and really great kids, and I'm glad to have about 65, 70% of them back this year, even when they found out what we were going to be up to. We're happy to be meeting every week and keeping everything alive.
Yeah. So you're doing then regular remote rehearsals then?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Each of our choirs from grades 2 through 12 is in 5 different choirs, is meeting up to about 2.5 hours a week in a couple of different sessions.
So just from a technical standpoint, there's a slight delay when you do this, right? So how do you conduct everybody remotely and keep them together?
We do not really do that. We we sing with a recording. We'll put the recording on and sing, or sing with the conductor. So luckily, each of our 3 conductors are wonderful singers and pianists. And so we're each, at a microphone, at a keyboard, and we're singing and playing, and everyone is muted at home singing with the conductor.
Uh-huh.
We're rehearsing in sections most of the time. Obviously, the conductor can't sing all 3 or 4 parts at once.
So joining us now is Annabelle Wade, who is a member of the chorus and a senior at Redmond High School. So have you done any kind of virtual singing before like this, or is this your first experience with remote rehearsal?
No, I have never had an experience like this. It's a very new experience for everyone.
I mean, how does it feel when you have to
you have to do your part basically solo, right? And at the same time, wonder if you're blending with everybody else, correct? So do you just imagine it in your head?
Yeah, it is a little isolating to have to do it on your own. You kind of just have to hope that everything works out when everything is put together. But getting to practice and sing is still an experience. I'm still so happy to be involved. But yeah, it is very different doing it alone. Quite isolating.
Yeah. Yes. So what was your first reaction when we began to realize how serious this was and that basically we all had to isolate, because that's the complete opposite of what choral groups are designed to do, right?
Yeah. To be honest, I was a little disappointed and upset. I was really sad that I was going to miss out on the experience of being together as a group, as we had been doing for so many years. But we recovered and we're still doing as much as we can. So it's still something. For us.
I'll jump in and say that, you know, some of the other heartbreaking things that we don't get to do. Well, I mean, the basic would be just hearing each other sing together. I mean, that sound, you do not get to hear that sound. But some of the other things are like the tours that our choirs go on.
Right.
So starting in the, you know, in fifth, sixth grade, but certainly even up until high school, I mean, we would have been going on an international tour at the end of this year. And we do not get to do that. It's just, you know, that kind of icing on the cake that we all look forward to that helps us get to know each other so much better and just see the world.
So, Sarah, what's your vision here as to how long it would take to get back to the way things were? And do you feel there are going to have to be some permanent changes that you make going forward?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I know that, unfortunately, singing is still on the list of things that are not the greatest things to do together.
Right.
I mean, from a, you know, from a health point of view, I guess. I know there are choirs around the country, some of whom are singing with masks and singing a certain beat apart or singing with the windows open. And
right.
We will need a lot more help from, you know, the medical community, I guess, for knowing how safe it can be. And what kind of permanent changes we may have to make.
Well, you could do the marching band thing and sing on a football field outdoors, six feet apart.
Yes, and, but and what try about the Seattle weather? Yeah, oh, man.
I know. Well, you know, raincoats, umbrellas, whatever. It's tough, isn't it?
Because, well,
I mean, you're meant to perform in close quarters indoors. So
exactly.
That's just about the worst format to have in this kind of context. Yeah. So how long has the Northwest Girl Choir been going?
This is our 48th year.
48th year.
Yeah.
And probably the toughest challenge you've faced in those 48 years.
I would have to say so. Yes. I can't think of another that would be quite like this.
And so this year, after the rehearsal, do you end up then with a full concert tape, essentially?
Not full in the traditional, like an hour and a half concert sense. You know, each song, each 3 or 4 minute song that we sing can take up to, I don't know, 30 or 40 hours of engineering all together collecting the audio and then, taking it apart, putting it together, fixing stuff, asking kids to resend stuff back, do it again.
Yeah.
So it just takes a lot more time.
It's been tough. It's been tough for all these organizations. I just look forward to the day when you and ACT and Seattle Opera and The Rep and Village Theater announce that they are reopening. And I have to think the audience on that first night will be beside itself with joy.
Wow. Well, thanks a lot. That sounds amazing. I want to be there.
Sarah Booz and Annabelle Wade. Thanks both.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We're in the middle of a pandemic, so this would be the ideal moment to sink your savings into opening a new restaurant. And here's Rachel Bell to explain why.
Every couple of weeks, I'll get an email about a new restaurant opening in Seattle. And I wonder, why would you ever start a new business in the middle of a pandemic?
I signed the lease October 11th.
We started our build out February 17th. Just about a month later, the COVID shutdown happened. And by then, it's too late.
A lot of people, they've sunk
hundreds of thousands of dollars into a space. They don't have the option to not do this.
So I signed my lease back in March of last year.
Victor Steinbrook signed the lease for his very first restaurant, Fremont's Local Tide, back in March of 2019. But because of COVID delays, he didn't open until this August.
Extremely daunting. I had numerous conversations with consultants and other people in the industry that advised me, you know, don't open, and even to possibly pull out depending on how much money was put in. Obviously not an option for me. Too much had gone into it at this point. And I wouldn't think about doing that anyways. We all understood what we were getting into, and we were ready for what came.
What came was shifting to takeout and a redesigned menu, because his original seafood concept wasn't going to hold up to takeout containers that could sit in a car for up to a half hour. But unfortunately, some clueless customers aren't giving restaurants a break. Front of house manager Nanette Jackson says people can be unnecessarily harsh on Yelp.
For things that are just so minute and unbelievable. So the crab roll. You can only order the crab roll when you come. You have to stand in line. People stand out here for an hour. So even if you call me at 12 and you say, hey, can I order a crab roll? I'm going to say no, because these people have been standing here, and that's respectful. This one guy left a 2-star review because he said the lady on the phone wouldn't let me order a crab roll. In a world where we live based off of ratings and social media, you don't understand the impact of when you do that.
Aaron T. Colvey is another new restaurant owner. He was set to open Sorrel in Seattle's Madison Valley just 4 days after the shutdown happened. When he eventually opened in July for takeout and limited seating, he could no longer afford a staff.
The truth is, it's just me. My wife has pitched in and is working front of house, but this isn't necessarily her profession. She works in childcare. I wear every single hat in the business right now.
He has created a super safe environment on the covered patio behind the restaurant.
We are only seating 2 tables at a night, and there are only up to 5 guests, and each table gets its own bathroom. We're actually never coming to the table. We use a landing table where we drop the dishes. It keeps us at least 6 feet away from the table.
Martha Fletcher has owned the Blarney Stone Pub near Pike Place Market since 2006. She had signed a lease for a new place in Queen Anne, anticipating the crowds from Kraken hockey fans. But because of COVID delays, she hopes to open Caird Public House in mid-November. If you would have seen this coming, would you not have opened a second location?
You know, I've thought about that a million times. I mean, there's obviously one side of me that says, oh, no, I wouldn't do it. But before I bought the Blarney Stone, I tried doing other things, you know, getting quote unquote a real job. But I just loved this business, even though it's so hard sometimes. I wouldn't trade it for the world, even now, which is people think I'm crazy, but I'm just trying to be positive and stay afloat until we can move on with life and get going again. You know, I might have pulled out. But luckily, I didn't have the choice.
Knowing what you know now, would you have opened a new space?
Oh, man, that is hard. I'm going to say maybe, because I think actually I had better opportunity here with this space to survive this moment, especially with the complete failure that unemployment has been and continues to be. I don't have any faith that as an independent contractor, I would have gotten help.
While others are struggling to stay afloat, Theo Dye has opened 2 new bubble tea shops during the pandemic. He signed his second lease in Kirkland in August and opened DIY Tea Lab just a few weeks later. So why did you decide to open a second location in the middle of all this?
The impact is not so bad for the bubble tea shop, but I'm also thinking maybe this is also an opportunity, because when a lot of places they close, meaning you can easily maybe get a cheaper rent or get a better lease.
Unlike a sit-down restaurant, most people take bubble tea to go anyway. And now Theo is looking to open a third location. Luckily, all of these owners have had forgiving landlords who gave them breaks on their rent when it was impossible to open early on in the pandemic.
Well, just 2 more things to say. Number one, I love bubble tea. And number two, be a little nicer on Yelp, okay? This is a tough business.
Oh my gosh, that's such a big deal. I think everybody listening needs to give these restaurants a break, because I've been hearing this from a lot of restaurant owners. People saying, my food was cold when I got it home. Well, that's what happens when you take it home. Sometimes you have to reheat it. And also, there are certain foods that will not taste good to go. If you are listening to the sound of my voice, I will tell you, do not order French fries if you're not eating them on site, because you're only going to be disappointed. And I just don't think it's fair to, you know, leave those reviews about things like that that are kind of out of the restaurant's hands. You know, if it's something that isn't worth complaining about, don't, or email them or call them. Don't take it out on restaurants on Yelp.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.